The following contains graphic discussions of murder and sexual violence. Listener discretion is advised.
I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions, a co-production of WGLT Radio and Reader Reporting. I'm Willis Kern, along with Scott Reeder. We've been investigating the mysterious death of 3-year-old Christina McNeil, who was found not breathing by her father in their Bloomington, Illinois apartment on June 16, 1998. Martin McNeil was convicted in connection with his daughter's death, though he has alleged since the day after the incident, it was his girlfriend, Masuk Nolan, who was responsible for Christina's death. Years later, Masuk was convicted of murdering her mother-in-law. Today, during Suspect Convictions, we have a couple of guests joining us via Skype. Scott, who do we have with us today?
We got two terrific guests. We have Rabia Chowdhury and Charlie Worrell. Rabia is the impetus behind the creation of Serial. She's the person who reached out to NPR to have that podcast created. She's a friend of the family of Adnan Syed. And Charlie is the co-host of Insight Podcast. She co-hosts it with a person from Australia, and they talk about a whole host of different crimes. Undisclosed is the podcast that Rabia puts out. She does an absolutely awesome job of analyzing a variety of cases of possible wrongful convictions. And they're both among my favorite podcasts to listen to. And very distinctly different, but both are excellent.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Why don't we start, Scott, sure, by having each of our guests talk a little bit about their podcast.
Sure.
What is the latest goings on at their end of the world, and they can bring us up to date on that. First, we'll go with Rabia.
So, we are in our third year of Undisclosed, and we began Undisclosed covering Adnan's case, which was the case at the heart of Serial for a season. Then we moved on to do other cases that came to us from different innocence projects. One was Joey Watkins out of Georgia. Then we have about four or five of them from the Philadelphia Innocence, from the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, all out of Philly, all from the same era, like the early 90s, when this was just a really horribly common phenomena. And, we one by one have been, we've been working with the attorneys on each of these cases, and almost every single one of them is in some various stage of appeal. And so we just wrapped up, I think, two cases out of Philly. We're starting our third one next week. We're doing them in kind of shorter bursts, but these are all defendants who are almost definitely innocent. And we are fairly committed to making sure that there is a process in court that gets them another chance at this. And so that's where we are. But we've gone through maybe about 10 stories so far.
And Charlie, tell us a little bit about your podcast and what's going on there.
Well, Insight, we used to focus mostly on unsolved crimes, but there are only so many that have enough information out there. And, you know, getting FOIA requests on unsolved cases usually get turned down because they're technically open. So we don't often have a lot of information. So we have kind of shifted. We're doing more cases that have been solved or have gone through the court system but need another look at them, or there's some kind of social issue behind them, like domestic violence or transphobia or something that we want to delve into. Sometimes we just do cases that are interesting to us. Next year, in 2018, we are taking the leap to going to twice a week. So that's the big thing we're prepping for right now. That'll give us a chance to have an extra episode to cover those smaller cases that don't have enough information for a full episode. We've been talking to families and people who are somehow connected to crime, whether their parent committed a crime or their family member was a victim. And so hopefully we'll bring a wider range of stories next year.
One of the things you just brought up, Robbie, is a lot of the crimes that you're looking at on your podcast come from the early 1990s. And It's interesting because this case we're looking at is from the 90s. What are the commonalities you find from that era?
Yeah, I mean, like even with Barton McNeil's case, I am seeing kind of the same types of patterns, which is you have untested forensic evidence. You have the police kind of making a decision on a suspect and then building a case around that suspect to the exclusion of anybody else. And for example, in Adnan's case and many other cases, they won't even take samples or test fingerprints or any other kinds of forensic against other potential suspects. So there's kind of this tunnel vision involved. You have kind of a fairly poor defense in many of these cases for a variety of reasons. And so there's a bunch of red flags that come at you, but when you and then in certain jurisdictions you'll see the same patterns depending on who you're dealing with. So the same, for example, in the Philadelphia series we're doing, the same detectives' names come up over and over and over, and witness coercion pops up in each one of these cases. You end up after many years with witnesses coming forward saying, I was threatened, I was told I had to testify like this, and it was Detective so-and-so, and it's like the same people keep popping up. Or you have prosecutorial misconduct in which, you know, they hide exculpatory evidence. You know, they're supposed to turn it over to the defense, and they don't. But in at the end of the day, it just seems like they just decide this is our guy, and they just ignore everything else, that could mean it, they're wrong.
What creates that mindset in law enforcement? I find it perplexing because I've been working on this season and the prior season, and it does seem like there's a tendency to find your suspect and then try to find the facts that surround the suspect. So, but why do they do that, Rabia?
You know, that's a question that I have asked other law enforcement officers and ex-officers. And another thing I didn't mention in my response earlier is the existence of false confessions, which is also fairly prevalent from that era, because police were trained in using something called the Reid interrogation technique, which has since been shown to just give you terrible false, you know, statements, just because it exhausts witnesses and they end up feeding the witnesses all this information. And, you know, the response I've gotten from law enforcement when I've asked, like, why does this happen? They actually really, it's not so much that it's shady or it's deliberately framing somebody who's innocent, but it's that they believe they have these gut instincts. They just know it. They don't believe they're doing anything wrong. And many times they don't even realize that they have ended up in the false confession scenario, feeding so much information to this person who then ends up just saying, all right, fine, I did it. And then 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people are like, nobody would confess unless they were really involved.
Charlie, what was your impression when you were listening to the podcast? What really struck you as things that stuck out when you were listening to it?
As far as Masuk goes, some of the things that stuck out to me is that, so the murder she ended up committing with her, you know, when she killed her mother-in-law, it seems so diabolical and so psychopathic, but it seems like she actually has maybe the opposite problem with instability in her emotions. Like, she, instead of not feeling enough, like we would think of a psychopath, she feels everything all the time and too much of it. And I'm wondering if she has a very serious personality disorder. Like you said in the podcast, we kind of have to piece together her childhood. But she lost a parent young. The remaining parent was abusive. She had a child taken from her, according to her, against her will for adoption. I'm wondering if she has just a very serious personality disorder that leads to these unstable reactions and these unstable reactions to rejection, especially. So that's kind of what I was thinking last night when I was listening to that episode, is I went into it thinking this woman's a psychopath, but I left it thinking I think there's something else going on.
You know, I spent a lot of time digging into who is Masuk, And I found out a lot of information, but I'm still kind of asking myself, who is this person? I mean, what motivates somebody to commit a crime like this? And in the benefit of hindsight, you look at this case and you're like, was she involved in this other case? I mean, is it possible? Are we looking at the right things here? I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Rabia?
Look, you know, when I listen to the 911 calls from the father and the repeated contacts he made with law enforcement, insisting that people come out, to me, that's a clear sign. I mean, that's not something most people would do if they were guilty. They would want, like, very low police involvement. I say that with a caveat that not everybody reacts the same in any given situation. But what I'm deeply troubled by here is that, well, we know she has the capability of committing an act like this in response to something that emotionally triggers her, a very similar trigger in both cases, but that it doesn't seem like, you know, any of the forensic evidence was tested against her. And so I would be happy to rule out somebody if you just make sure that they're also, you know, included in the pool of people who are, you know, taken through the forensic testing. And the fact that she wasn't is very problematic to me. I think she's a very, very likely suspect. And to me, I don't feel comfortable. The only circumstantial evidence tying Barton to this crime is that he was home that night, and that's just not enough. I understand that the prosecution made claims of sexual abuse, but frankly, I'm not quite sure what the evidence presented on that end was. And so if I'm missing something, then maybe there's something there. But other than him being home that night, it's just not enough.
Well, it's interesting because even the prosecution now seems to have backed away from some of the forensic evidence that was presented 20 years ago. There was an enlargement of the rectum on Christina. I always feel a little bit shy about talking about this stuff on the air, but you know, this is the evidence, so we need to talk about it. But there was an enlargement in the rectum on Christina. And what forensic science has kind of learned over the last 20 years is that doesn't necessarily indicate sexual abuse at all. It's part of the rigor mortis process. The orifice just gets larger as after death. One of the prosecutions hired a new pathologist to come in and look and said, yes, but there was some sort of swelling or redness around the vulva. And that could indicate that, yeah, there was sexual abuse taking place. On the other hand, you know, the defense pathologist is saying, well, no, that doesn't necessarily mean that at all. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but we know that disproportionately sexual abuse is committed by men. But we also know that murder is disproportionately committed by men. We know that Masuk ended up becoming a murderer, so she's in that minority of murderers that are female. Could she be in that minority of sex abusers that's female, if there was sex abuse that took place? I don't know. Nobody really will know. But we don't even really know if sex abuse took place in this case. It seems very ambiguous. If I was to guess, having read the autopsy reports and interviewed folks, I think there probably was some sort of sex abuse that happened. But bottom line is, we don't know who did that. I don't think you can make an assumption, well, he's male, so, and males usually commit this crime, so it had to be him. I don't think that's an accurate assumption anymore. But I'll throw it out to the two women in this conversation. What do they think? Charlie?
I have children and three-year-olds touch themselves and will cause redness. She could have had some kind of, I don't know if she's probably potty trained, but she could still have had some kind of diaper rash or yeast infection or something. So I'd want to know that they ruled those options out for the cause of the swelling and the redness. But they can't date it. I don't know. Barton was surely not the only man in her life. I don't know. You know, she probably had uncles. She probably had grandparents. She probably had all sorts of people in her life that, saying that one man, because he's a man and because he was in the house that day, had to have been the one who did it, I'm also not comfortable with that. And saying that, you know, Masuk or Barton had to have been the one sexually abusing her, I'm also not comfortable with that, because, I mean, these, you can cast a kind of wide net when you really look at a child's circle. I'm just not comfortable pointing a finger at anyone for being the perpetrator of sex abuse when we don't know if it happened, and two, we don't know who else is in her circle that she sees on a regular basis.
And what do you think, Robin?
And I would add that the absence of any semen on her body, on her clothing, on her bedding, to me also, you know, I mean, like, that's the kind of evidence I would look for. And I know there's certain testing that couldn't be done maybe in the 90s that can be done today that could search for other kinds of DNA evidence that's not just semen, but even other kinds of DNA evidence that if somebody had touched her in that area recently, that would have left some kind of trace DNA to be tested. And so I hope they're able, that the Innocence Project is able to get, if those samples exist, retested to see if there's traces. I mean, if there's, but even then, I mean, like, okay, if you're a father and you're helping your three-year-old go to the restroom, there might be some trace DNA because your fingers touched her, but not inappropriately. So, yeah, to me, it's not enough evidence to suggest that there was sexual abuse by anybody, to be honest. Like Charlie said, there's a number of different reasons. It could be redness or swelling.
I'm going to reveal a little bit of new information here that we haven't revealed yet in the podcast. We do know that when the Illinois Innocence Project became involved in this case, they began to look at a variety of things. And one of the things they got is some DNA testing done. Now, according to Barton McNeil, the sheets were freshly laundered. We have the receipt from where he dropped off clothing at the laundromat to be washed. Prosecutors will say, well, just because he has this receipt doesn't mean that those sheets were laundered. We just know that he took laundry to the laundromat and picked it up. We don't know if those sheets were included. We do have the lab report from the Illinois State Police Crime Lab, where the lab tech says the sheets smell freshly laundered and appear clean, other than where Christina's bodily fluids had come out at postmortem. But they did some more testing, and they found Masuk's DNA on the sheets. It could be nothing. It could be significant. One of the things is they were freshly laundered sheets. Bart says she hadn't been in the house for like a week before that. Prosecutors say, well, wait a minute. Now, this is the bed where Bart usually slept. And, you know, Masuk has been his girlfriend for 3 years. Maybe something came off the mattress or something like that. It does raise some interesting questions, don't you guys think? Rabia?
This is the kind of thing that really kind of gets to me, is that you can create whatever kind of narrative you want to make excuses for the evidence, depending on where you're coming at, you know, a case from. So now you have the prosecution saying, well, sure, maybe it was her DNA, but it came off of his body. Instead of doing the right thing and just testing everything against her, whether it's hair, fingerprints, everything, and really seriously considering these possibilities given her history now. And they know, you know, she was connected to another murder. You know, has she had a psych evaluation done? Has she been violent to other people? What is Barton McNeil's background? Has he ever, you know, been involved in hurting other children? All these things matter. And when it's deflected so easily, well, okay, so we found some DNA. I mean, that's, to me, that's significant. You have a crime lab saying they seem freshly laundered, and okay, that backs up this guy's story. I just feel like they're twisting themselves in knots to ignore a real possibility that they got it wrong.
How about you, Charlie?
I always get uncomfortable when I feel like the state is picking and choosing which evidence to weigh. So they'll dismiss this DNA stuff, but they're going to put a whole lot into some swelling on her body. And I get really uncomfortable when we start, like Robbie said, fitting the evidence to the theory rather than the other way around. And one thing in cases we've looked at is DNA is very difficult to really analyze, like do deductive reasoning with, when the person is supposed to be in that space. So if there's the DNA of a wife and her husband, you know, wife goes missing and there's her DNA in her husband's trunk, well, that could have gotten there when she unloaded the groceries. You know, we can't always fit that. So I understand where the prosecution is coming from. I'm just concerned that they're so willing to just, that this gets crossed off because it doesn't fit.
This is Suspect Convictions. I'm Willis Kern along with Scott Reeder, and we're talking with our guests Rabia Chowdhury of the podcast Undisclosed and Charlie Worrell with the Insight podcast. Upcoming during Suspect Convictions, it's your chance to question Barton McNeil about this case in an episode we're calling Ask Barton McNeil. Scott, how can listeners ask Barton McNeil a question?
They can simply send a question they want. They really want to ask the defendant, Barton McNeil, to askbart@suspectconvictions.com, which segues right into my question for you two. If you have an opportunity to ask Barton McNeil any question, what would you ask him? How about you, Charlie?
So something that strikes me is that he didn't hear anything, and that sticks with me. I'm the primary caretaker of my children, and so I hear if they cough in the other room and it sounds a little funny, whatever I'm doing stops and I listen. So I understand that he didn't have full custody of his daughter, so maybe he wasn't as in tune to every little noise happening. But I would ask, you know, really, why did he think he didn't hear it? And I also wondered, did he leave the home at any point that evening? Did he go outside? Did he go to his car to get something? Is there any explanation for why he was one room over and didn't hear it?
Okay. Now, what he would say is he had headphones on and a fan was running in the bedroom and a fan was running in the living room where he was on the computer with his headphones on, and there was no air conditioning going. It was an older apartment without air conditioning. But that's a good question. How about you, Robbie? Anything in particular come to mind?
Yeah, my understanding is that at some point after he put her to bed, put Christina to bed, he thought he did hear her talking, and he checked in on her, and it seemed like she was talking to herself and smiling. And I mean, that's what I read in one of the articles. And then he said, go back to sleep type of thing, and left. And that was, and then he didn't check in on her until the next morning. My question would be, like, was that unusual behavior for her? Was that something she did normally? Or was that, like, an indication that maybe somebody else was in the room with her? Because if that's something his daughter did all the time, then maybe it's not unusual. But, like, none of my kids do that. And if I walk into a room and they're talking kind of to themselves, sitting up, smiling, talking to themselves as she was described, I would be like, something's going on here. Something's really odd here.
Is, you know, having raised three daughters, or still in the process of raising three daughters, nothing happens quietly involving a three-year-old. I mean, that's just been my experience. I mean, I have three really loud children. I mean, especially when they were three. Where I struggle here is, could somebody come through that window stealthily and then suffocate a three-year-old in such a manner that it wouldn't wake up the whole neighborhood? When one of my kids stubs their toe in the middle of the night, the whole house hears it.
Well, I'll be honest. Look, I have two daughters. I have a son now. Both my daughters, my oldest daughter was very, very quiet. Very quiet. And my second daughter, who's nine, is much more precocious and assertive, but she also gets frightened very easily. And I've seen them both in situations where they got scared and they just froze. So not all kids are the same, I would say. And if it was somebody talking to her that she knew, you know, who said, shh, don't tell anybody here, it's a secret, it's a game. Like, I can totally see one of my daughters at that age having, like, played that game. And to smother a child, I mean, I don't know how she was, but I assume with a pillow or something, how could...
They think that she was face down into the mattress is the way it was done. Yeah. Just horrible.
I think it could be done without a sound having escaped her because of the way she was killed. So maybe she would have kicked and moved, but maybe not been able to scream.
We haven't talked about the window evidence. I mean, that's something that the defense has hung a lot of their case on. You know, the screens were cut right above the latches where you can unhook the window and enter. Prosecution seems very dismissive of this. We don't know when those screens were cut, but it doesn't matter when the screens were cut. The fact that they were cut and there was accessibility. I mean, does this raise a red flag for either of you?
Yeah, I think that the window was accessible from the outside to open it rather quietly, that really does matter, because there's a huge question of how could someone have gotten in here? Well, now here's the defense saying here's how someone could have gotten in here. The cobweb stuff and all that, I don't really, that, I mean, nobody can really say for sure any of that. But accessibility, someone being able to get in that home and hurt the child is the entire alternative theory. And so we can't dismiss it. It's the defense's case.
How about you, Rabia?
No, I think that's, I mean, that's evidence you have to consider in this case. And if it was cut in the places that would give access to the latches, you know, there might be evidence on the outside of that window frame. How was it cut? Like, what was the tool used to cut it? Look for that. Just the fact that it wasn't investigated, to me, is a big gaping hole in the whole case. I think it was, I think the police, whether or not they got it right, they got their investigation wrong.
Well, let me ask you this. Robbie, you're an attorney. One of the things that struck me is, I didn't say odd, but interesting, is that the defense attorney in this case asked for a bench trial rather than a jury trial. And they didn't present any expert witnesses in the case at all. In fact, the only defense witness was Barton McNeil himself. Does this strike you as a good trial strategy to go with a bench trial in a case like this?
I mean, from a defense perspective, unless you have an incredibly airtight case, I would never be comfortable with a bench trial. And in a situation like this where, while I don't know if there was a lot of evidence to convict, I don't know if there's, I mean, look, yeah, ideally innocent until proven guilty. That's really not how the system works. On some level, defendant has to prove his innocence. And not being able to prove your innocence puts you in a really precarious position. Going with a jury trial, I mean, you have 12 shots. You know, you have 12 shots. You just need one person to say, nope, I don't believe it, I'm not buying it, to get a hung jury. I think it was a poor trial strategy. And then you have the issues with, I mean, this judge ruling that no other alternative evidence could have come in about the other suspect. It was poorly calculated. I was very surprised with that decision. I don't know. Maybe there was a reason for it. Maybe this attorney knew the judge had a certain record on these kinds of cases and relied on that. Or they thought that their defendant would play really poorly in front of a jury. I mean, we also remember, I think it was like the 80s, 90s, there was many, many cases involving false confessions even, but false accusations of child molestation and daycares and all kinds of things. And, you know, also the satanic fervor was around. So there might have been reasons he thought, I don't want to put this guy in front of a jury. He's a single dad. There's a lot out there that prejudices people to begin with. And but I just think you have 12 shots when you have a jury.
When I read the transcripts, there's no evidence rebutting any of the expert testimony. And obviously, the Innocence Project has been able to find expert witnesses to rebut the testimony 20 years later. Why couldn't the public defender handling this case 20 years ago find expert witnesses to rebut it? Why wasn't that presented in that mix? And it really raises some red flags for me. I mean, I'm just kind of asking myself, I don't know. I mean, it just seems to me to be a strange thing. You have some experience with public defenders. Rabia, do you have any thoughts on why that might have been?
Look, public defenders are notoriously overworked. And I think, you know, again, I know nothing about this attorney. I know nothing about his caseload, his or her caseload, about how they did another trials. I mean, I'm surprised, like, you know, maybe in a lot of cases like this, you know, public defenders will, and private attorneys will seek a plea deal because they want to avoid a trial. And also because they don't have time for so many trials. Take a long, long time. It takes a long time to prepare. Public defenders have very low resources. They don't have tens of thousands of dollars to hire experts. And they also have to kind of prioritize, you know, with the limited resources, where they're going to use them for the different cases. So it's hard to kind of blame a PD in a situation where they're just really strapped for time and resources, but maybe could have done a better job on trial strategy if they were going to go that way.
One of the ways I think the public defender was also kind of just set up for failure is that unless, you know, Michael Peterson, we watched The Staircase, and he has this whole team of lawyers who have their own investigators who are investigating the case themselves and rerunning evidence, the public defender can't do any of that. They're almost entirely reliant on the police investigation. And if the police aren't testing things and the state's not testing it and then turning it over, the public defender has very little to work with except what the state chooses to provide.
Obviously, the current state's attorney was not in this office 20 years ago. The assistants now working this case were not in the office when this case was prosecuted. Have you noticed, Rabia, a reticence, though, for prosecutors to admit that perhaps a colleague or a predecessor made a mistake just because they're in the same position that's now being held?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is like the thing about inertia when it comes to the law and legal process is that it's very carefully guarded and fostered. Finality of convictions, precedents, like people in the legal world don't want things to change. It's a cultural issue in many ways. You have the rebels who every so often you'll hear of a DA who's come in and said, there was a problem in this era or during the time of this, you know, detective on a certain beat and we're going to review all these cases. Those prosecutors are considered like just kind of these, you know, heroes and rebels in the criminal justice community because they're so rare. And, you know, right now I'm really interested in seeing what happens in Philadelphia because of the very recent election of Larry Krasner, who is a lifelong criminal defense attorney and civil rights attorney and had sued the Philadelphia Police Department 75 times. He just won. He is now the top prosecutor in Philadelphia beginning January. And he has promised to turn that office on its head and you know, change things that have been the same for decades. And it's about time. And I hope to see that kind of, I guess, revolution in a way in a lot of different jurisdictions. But that is the status quo, preserving a conviction, keeping those notches on belts. And these communities, like you said, I mean, like they go on to really take care of themselves. You have these prosecutors become judges, right? So if you have a new prosecutor come in, well, that old prosecutor could be in still a position of leverage over that new prosecutor because maybe they're a judge now or what have you. And they also have to work with police officers. They have to work with other colleagues who you tick off the wrong person. It could hurt how your work gets done.
I'm going to ask you the big question. If you guys were sitting on the jury on this case, with the evidence that's been presented so far in the podcast that you've heard, is there reasonable doubt?
I mean, for me, beyond a doubt, there's reasonable doubt. If you cannot prove to me that he killed this child with the evidence necessary, then that is reasonable doubt.
I agree with Rabia. I feel like they haven't proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he did it. Now, he has a hard time explaining things, but that's not how it's supposed to work. They're supposed to prove it. And because they failed to test things that would rule out that doubt, if they tested the windowsill outside, if they did some other tests, then, or, you know, maybe question Masuk a little longer, I think they didn't prove the case because they didn't even look for enough evidence.
Now, of course, what you'd hear from a prosecutor is, yeah, obviously we proved the case. He was found guilty. So we did, the case was proven. He was found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, once somebody's convicted, the presumption is of guilt, not of innocence. Do you think that the evidence that's been presented so far by the Illinois Innocence Project has been sufficient to override that presumption of guilt?
You know, they have a real uphill battle right now because, you know, part of the issue is going to be, at least, and I don't know exactly under Illinois law how it goes, but generally speaking, to get in front of a judge again on a case like this, you can't just say there were things that could have been done that weren't done. It has to rise to the level of like new evidence that could not have been found at the time. But I mean, I in this case would try to find separate evidence, meaning, you know, do more investigation, really, really intense investigation to Masuk's whereabouts that night, see if she talked to other people, see if they can get independent testing done. But it has to be really new evidence.
Any thoughts, Charlie?
One thing that I've definitely learned through, you know, researching podcasting and reading appeals documents is that that bar is really high. I've read appeals documents where it pretty much says, oh yeah, they did this and this was wrong, but it probably wouldn't have changed things enough.
Anything you want to ask, Willis?
Well, I just had one question for our guests to kind of wrap things up here. Based on what you've heard from the podcast and maybe some of the reading you've done on this case over the time that you've been preparing for this appearance on the show today, how do you each of you think Christina died? We'll go with Charlie first.
Okay. I listened to the roundtable, and I thought Bob Ruff's explanation of in the process of being assaulted or something, or she started making noise so the person had smothered her. But, you know, I don't know. We did a case where a woman was convicted of killing her infant, and they said that she had smothered them. She said it was SIDS. It's really hard to prove that someone's been smothered. So I'm going to say there's a big question mark. I'm interested in hearing more. I don't know all the details of the autopsy report that says why they believe she was smothered and didn't just have an asthma attack or respiratory arrest. So I'm just big open mind here. I don't know.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, if she was smothered, I think there would be other indicators for that. And so like Charlie, haven't looked carefully at the autopsy report. I don't know if it's available, but there, you know, when somebody is strangled or smothered, there is other kinds of trauma that happens physiologically that I would look for. I would look for other kinds of signs of injury. I would look for signs of struggle. You know, if there's like no sign of struggle in that child's bed, you know, like, you know, if somebody's being, you know, like, you know, was she clutching at things? Are there injuries to the back of her neck? Were there pressure marks? I mean, there's so many other things that it would take to say that this is definitively how she died or didn't die. I feel like there's only two possibilities. Either it was inadvertent, although I don't necessarily believe that because it takes time to really kill a person. I mean, it's not like the 10 seconds, 30 seconds, hands around the neck. But it was in response to like her protesting something happening to her, or it was totally premeditated. And, you know, whoever did it had the intention of doing it, and it wasn't connected to any other assault or anything else.
Well, thank you guys. I appreciate you taking your time for us and coming on. We'd love it. I highly recommend to our listeners both of these podcasts. Both of these women just do an absolutely excellent job, and we'd love to have you guys back on sometime in the future.
Oh, thank you, Scott.
Yep, thank you so much. It was great to be on.
Thanks to each of our guests today, Rabia Chowdhury of the podcast Undisclosed and Charlie Worrell with the Insight Podcast. Upcoming during Suspect Convictions, it's your chance to question Barton McNeil about this case in an episode we're calling Ask Barton McNeil. To submit your question for this episode, send an email to askbart@suspectconvictions.com. That's askbart@suspectconvictions.com. Next week, we delve into the murder which landed Bart's girlfriend, Masuk, in prison. A look at the death of her mother-in-law, Linda Tida.
Her claim was that it was self-defense, that they had a fight, and that she had no choice but to strangle her mother-in-law in order to defend herself.
That's next week during Suspect Convictions. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kern. We'll see you next week on Suspect Convictions.